Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
My name is Valerie Miles. It's wonderful to be here in Cartagena with Clear David.
David, perfect.
I'm learning. It's really wonderful to be in Cartagena again this year. It's a fantastic festival and always so full of so many wonderful people and a chance to learn new things. So thank you for coming out with us tonight. We're going to be talking today with Fleer. She is a Welsh writer who writes in Welsh and translates herself into English. She's a novelist. She has 4 novels. Today we're going to be talking about The White Trail. Particularly, and also her newest novel that is now going to be made into a movie. She's also a screenwriter and a very well-known folk singer. And we're actually at the end of the conversation, we'll have a chance to listen to her sing a folk song for us. So thank you very much, Fleer, for being here with us. She's won a number of prizes, and she's also, in 2009, you were the Oxfam winner of the Hay. And she's a fellow, and she's having a chance to travel the world and see all the Hay festivals in the different parts of the world. So, but today, we're going to begin. First, I think it's very interesting to have someone like Fleer here to talk about language and identity. First of all, and imagination. Especially in a place like Colombia, last year, L'Eclesio was here. He came for the Bogota Book Fair. And he had a lot to say, particularly about the languages that are spoken here, the number of languages in Colombia. So it's very interesting to have the chance to talk with someone who works in a language within the context of English, which is kind of such an absorbing world language, that we're going to talk about these things. So I thought first, let's give ourselves a little bit of context to understand more about the Welsh language.
Okay, well, thank you, Valerie. It's great to be here. Buenas tardes. To give you a little bit of the history of the Welsh language, it goes back to the 6th century. It's essentially evolved from an Indo-European language. And from the Brythonic language, which is the kind of original British language. So the original British were actually the Welsh. And then evolved into this kind of contemporary language that we speak today. For me, it's my social reality from day to day. I speak Welsh every day with my family, with my kids. My parents are Welsh speakers. My grandparents were Welsh speakers. And it goes back generations and generations in my family. Wales is a small country of 3 million people, and out of 3 million people, 700,000 people speak Welsh. So it's a minority within a small country. But like I said, for me, it's my daily social reality. And we also have Welsh language television, we have Welsh language radio. And so I'm surrounded by it everywhere. But I then work in an university in an English department. So I guess that is the kind of strange dual identity that I have, that all day I'm teaching through the medium of English, but then I go home and converse in Welsh with my family.
I should mention very quickly, unfortunately, Binyavanga Wainaina is not going to be here with us today. He had something come up personally, and so he couldn't make it, so I'm very sorry about that. Just wanted to let you know. Now, Fleer, your family has had a lot to do with this generation in Wales, right? Mm. I mean, your father was actually imprisoned for his activism on behalf of the language.
Yeah. I grew up with Welsh language activist parents. So me and my brother were always going on marches. We were part of protests. And my father was involved in a big campaign in the 70s, campaigning for a Welsh language television station, which we didn't have in the 70s. And so he represented a group of 12 people who demolished a television mast. And then he and the chairman of the Welsh Language Society stood trial for it in court. And they ended up being imprisoned for a year while I was a baby. My mother also was involved in protest and has been to prison several times for acts of political activism. So during, I guess, the 60s and 70s, we saw this huge kind of national uprising, people protesting for things like as basic as not having bilingual road signs. All our road signs were in English in our own country. We didn't have Welsh language television, we didn't have Welsh language radio. All these campaigns were successful in the end. And the one great example that I like to quote is the fact that one of our MPs, Gwynfor Evans, in the 70s threatened to go on hunger strike if Margaret Thatcher didn't give us a Welsh language television station. And the lady who was not for turning turned because of this, because the nationalism rose and rose and rose, and everybody was campaigning, and Gwynfor Evans was saying that he was going to, you know, die for this cause. And in the end, the Conservative government did do an U-turn, and they gave us our television channel. And I guess my generation now are really reaping the rewards of that and are able to be screenwriters in our own language.
Well, you know, it's not just anyone can get Margaret Thatcher to change her mind.
Only the Welsh. Yeah.
Exactly. I should say, you know, in Colombia, you know, through Le Clésio and much of the things, there's another French anthropologist who's done a very important study. His name was Lamburu, and he did a very important study. And as a result of this study, they've found that there's about, according to his study, 65 different native languages spoken in Colombia, of which 5 are like right on the verge of extinction right now. And he actually, when he was here, he went to visit the last men who speak one of the native languages. And I know there's about 20 others that are kind of on the verge of extinction. And it makes you think, what happens? What is it? What would happen to a language that dies? What happens?
And it's frightening when I hear stories like that. And there is a Welsh language novel about this that a famous Welsh language author, Sloane Fóinne Ellis, wrote about the future of the Welsh language and imagined that it was only one little woman in a cottage that spoke it. And for us, it sort of woke us up a little bit, because you tend to get complacent. I mean, I was just saying earlier to Valerie, Welsh is around me everywhere, and it's on the radio, it's on the television, and I speak it with my family, my friends. And sometimes you forget this is not the majority language of the world, and it certainly isn't the majority language even of your own country, which is kind of, it's a deeply unsettling thing. And I guess that part of my activism, I'm not sort of politically active in the same way that my parents were, because I think colonization is getting a more complex thing to kind of detect. We have our own assembly government, we have a bilingual road signs, we have, you know, there is a strong presence to the language in Wales, but there are still lots and lots of battles to be won. And I guess what I'm feeling now is that my activism is coming through in my work. And one of the reasons I made the decision to write in English was because I wanted to write about the Welsh language, and I wanted to bring it to worldwide attention. I wanted to take it out of the country. And so in a bizarre way, English has enabled me to write more about my Welsh experience.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, because I know, I think in a lot of the world, a lot of things are happening now in favor of keeping languages and like the diversity and the variety of languages in the world, because of course, When a language dies, that means that a whole way of thinking changes, a way of imagining ourselves as human beings, no? Mm. And I know the Ministry of Culture here in Colombia is doing quite a bit now to take care of that and the languages, and to make sure that they don't die out. But the feeling of, now you write in Welsh, but you translate yourself into English, is that right?
Yeah.
So that way of seeing the world being Welsh and the way of seeing the world as being English must be very different.
Yes, They are very different, and I feel that I become a different writer when I'm writing in English as opposed to writing in Welsh. And also, the approach changes. So when I'm writing in Welsh, I know who my readers are going to be. I have an idea of who they are. And a lot of my Welsh language novels are satirical. And so I'm kind of laughing at the absurdity of our culture. I'm poking fun at it. I'm making fun of myself as a Welsh language speaker. All our traditions, all our quirks, our idiosyncrasies. When I'm writing in English, I have totally different motivation. In some ways, I don't want to let the rest of the world know how bizarre we are, how absurd we are. I have a different kind of approach because I'm kind of protecting that culture, I guess, and I'm picking out all the things that are good and interesting and diverse, and I'm presenting that to the rest of the world in sort of more, I don't know, in a more sort of direct fashion and without such a satirical tone, I guess. So, you know, there are some of my Welsh language readers who think I'm terrible for satirising national institutions and making fun of the Welsh, but my English language readers are warming towards the Welsh in reading me in English, which is, I am a split personality, I think.
I can imagine. It must be very difficult. But at the same time, it's kind of like, it reminds me, like I was saying, of the Borges story, no, Pierre Menard. It's, you're retelling the Quixote, right?
Yeah, the
author of the Quixote.
Yeah.
But now, the one of the good things, though, is that now in this novel, the novel that we're talking about today, which is The White Trail, you had a chance to go back to retell the story of an ancient Welsh text.
Yes, it's a group, it's a medieval cycle of tales called the Mabinogion. Mabinogion means tales of youth. And these were tales that were kind of written down from oral storytellers, I think in the 10th or the 11th century, and they've been with us since then. And they keep on being revisited and reinterpreted. And when I was a student at school, when I was 16, I was studying the tales in the original Middle Welsh. And we were asked during our exams just to translate from Middle Welsh into contemporary Welsh, which is a really boring exercise and I hated it. But to have a publisher then say, okay, why don't you just rewrite one of the tales from your own perspective, you can do anything with it, and to write it in English from the Welsh original. Like I was saying to you, that's felt to me very hugely subversive, like something I would have been told off for doing in school. And suddenly, once I'd begun this tale and I was allowed to take it off in any direction I wanted to, this epic love story quest full of heroes and heroines and villains, it got scaled down to this kind of intimate story about one guy whose wife goes missing while she's pregnant and a mystery of, you know, how he comes to find her. And it's the kind of book that I never would have written without having the kind of template that I had in the Mabinogion tales. So I felt like it was, taking on something that was really particular to our culture and very unique, and being able to turn it into a tale that would communicate beyond Wales, which is the exciting thing.
It also has the feeling of the fairy tale, of course, and we were mentioning earlier that it's a very great place to be talking about a novel like this in Cartagena with its magical realism touch to it. But the thing about fairy tales and the thing about the old texts are they bring us into a place that sometimes is very dark. Mm. You know, fairy tales can be in incredibly dark stories, and here in this novel, I think one of the wonderful things is how you explore some of these areas, for example, as pregnancy and childbirth from a completely different perspective.
Mm. Yeah, I just had a baby when I was writing this, and I was also very, very sleep deprived. And I think sometimes that helps the magic realism imagination, because you are having visions all the time. And it was the kind of book that nobody kind of expected me to write, because I just had a baby, and the idea of this woman going missing, and I won't spoil the mystery, but it's quite a violent tale as well, and it adheres to the kind of structure of the original tale, because there's a lot of violence and darkness in folk tales, and especially in the Mabinogion. And I guess I hadn't really thought about the significance of what I was writing at the time, but But a lot of some people have seen it as this the kind of also the writer's desire to kind of get away from some of their responsibilities, and there's this notion of like motherhood clashing with creativity. And actually, I haven't found that, because I found that being a mother has made me more creative and more determined to write, actually, and to make use of my time. But there is something interesting about the way folk tales represent women and the way women are represented in my culture. And in the Mabinogion, women are seen as just flawed creatures constantly. They're, you know, they are always doing bad things, always punished. They're being turned into owls. They're being made to suffer. And actually, I wanted to investigate a kind of a deeper identity. And I wanted to think, you know, it just mentions in the original tale that this woman has a baby and she goes mad. And that's it. You know, no explanation. Just move on to the next bit of the story. And I thought, well, actually, I wanted to know why she went mad and where she, you know, where did she go, and what was her thought process, what were her emotions. And I guess I'm trying in The White Trail to give voice to the silenced characters of the tale, and especially the women who in the folk tales seem like they have no choice whatsoever. They just have to fit into this story.
Yes, and we were talking about how not much has changed over so many centuries, no, with the tropes of horror stories. And, yeah. You know, it's always kind of like the girl who's turning into a woman who's the one that first gets it, no? But there's also issues of one of the things that I thought was interesting and reverberates somewhat is the part of the missing people. The fact that they're all the missing people end up being in one same place. And one very dogged detective ends up actually finding them.
Yeah, the tale of the missing people. I don't know, I have a fascination with disappearance. I don't know what it is, but and perhaps it's cultural as well, thinking about people disappearing and where they go. We're having a discussion recently at our book club in Wales about how, as Welsh language speakers, we feel like we're not allowed to leave our country. We're not allowed to leave our culture. And one woman was saying, you know, when she was younger, she would travel a lot with her parents, and they'd go to different schools in different countries. But how we've kind of, I guess, as parents decided, no, we have to stay here and we have to be in this culture, we have to speak this language. So maybe there's a degree of kind of that we are tied and we feel that we have to make that contribution and we have to keep our culture alive. And I think subconsciously there's something there about, you know, the freedom of that individual who just goes missing, and that some people who just do walk out of their lives and are not tied to anything and have that freedom. And it's kind of an investigation of that other kind of identity, which seems kind of alien to me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Did you find when you were kind of retelling the old tale that it was difficult to adapt it to a modern setting? And because I know towards the end when you talk about the process that you went through, I thought it was very interesting how you said that you had followed a number of different trails, but in the end realized that it wasn't about retelling, it was about the silences that are there, like you said.
Yeah. Because when I started reading the tale again, the tale is originally called How Culhwch Won Olwen, so a love story about this guy Culhwch who goes after Olwen. And I found that their characters were quite dull and uninteresting. They, like the characters of a folk tale are, they're usually one-dimensional. They're usually there just to tell the moral tale. And I was looking more for the things that were peculiar and the things that were missing. And the things that were missing were this kind of the whole relationship that Culhwch's parents would have had before he was born, and the complexity of their relationship. And I think that's what you do when you rewrite something. You think about a trail that you can follow that nobody else would have thought of following. And once you go on that journey, you then find yourself sort of turning back to the original tale whenever you get stuck. That's what I was doing. So when I got to a point in the story, I thought, I really don't know what's going to happen now, I would turn back to the original tale and maybe see a little detail, like there are 40 tasks that the hero is asked to complete, and one of these involves these little birds who lull the living and wake the dead. And so this was a little detail that suddenly threw in another part of the plot, and I went off on that trail, and that was new and surprising. And so even though I had freedom to do what I wanted to do creatively, it was nice to have the tale to bring me back to these little surreal moments. And I think it's that kind of fusion that's made this turn into a magic realism book, actually, mm-hmm. Rather than fantasy.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how it gets so deeply into the human psyche and the way that we are as human beings. It's quite unbelievable, in fact, you know, that coming from these ancient texts and bring it to a modern time, there can be still so much underneath there, so much detritus, no? That's removed somehow.
Well, I wanted
the forest.
I wanted the husband who's lost his wife to be believable, and you know, I wanted to investigate how he would have felt about everything that was happening to him, and he's quite hapless, and he makes lots of mistakes in the wake of his wife's disappearance, and he does stupid things, and like we all do when we're suffering with something, we do not what is believable, I guess, and we do silly things and incredible things, and I wanted to investigate all of that, you know, in the wake of trauma, what happens.
Guilt. No, when
absolutely, and he's, you know, and he feels guilt for not noticing, you know, what was going on, and he's at sea, and he's the kind of male character, I must say, that I tend to write time and time again. It's like the long-suffering husband, probably like my husband, who's looking after the kids right now. But, you know, I wanted to investigate, you know, that kind of complexity of character. And sometimes I find it easier to do it through a male perspective and remove myself from the situation a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to read just a paragraph, and the translators will stop translating this. So if you don't hear the translation, what we'd really like you to do is just listen to the sound of the language. She's going to read first a paragraph in English and then a paragraph in Welsh so that you can hear the difference in the languages, and then I'll read the same paragraph in Spanish.
It was on a day when Goleddyd was at her most visible, more visible than she'd ever been in her life, that she seemed to vanish into thin air. How could you lose a pregnant wife in a supermarket? That's what people were asking. He watched the news item every night in a stupor, as if he were watching a story about someone else, as if it was some other unfortunate being he saw snivelling into his fleece at the press conference, eyes at half-mast. We are all concerned for my wife's safety, he heard the sap say. She is 9 months pregnant and very vulnerable. Very vulnerable. How she would have hated that. She had never been vulnerable in her life, let alone invisible. She wasn't a woman you could miss, a splay of wild red hair twirling like a tornado about her small, perfectly formed face. A woman who walked in bold, quick strokes. It was always you who had to step aside, never her. But as she had prophesied, the pregnancy changed her. As she grew bigger and bigger, she somehow retreated into herself, became half the woman she had been, even as her flesh doubled. Her red hair stood static on her head, became a matted pink mess. She walked as though trudging through treacle, the whole world around her a gloopy, arduous struggle. She was all too visible, and yet ever so slowly disappearing. Ar ddwrnod lle roedd hi ar ei mwyaf gweledol, yn fwy gweledol nag y bu erioed, fe ddiflannodd hi. Sut allai rhywun golli gwraig feichiog mewn archfarchnad? Dyna'r oedd pobl yn ei holi. Fe wyliodd cilydd yn newyddion fel pa bai'n gwylio hanes rhywun arall, fel pa bai'n gwylio rhyw greadur triennus yn crio ar y sgrin, nad oedd yn ddim i'w wneud ag e. Rwy'n i'n gofidio am fy ngwraig, meddai. Mae hi 9 mis yn feichiog ac yn fregus dros ben. Bregus. Fe fydd y goleuddydd wedi cysau'r gair hwnnw.
Bonito, ¿verdad?
Gracias.
Fue un día en que Goleddyd estaba más que visible. Más visible de lo que había estado jamás, en el que al parecer se esfumó en el aire. ¿Cómo pierdes una esposa embarazada en el supermercado? Se preguntaba la gente. Kiltith veía las noticias cada noche sumida en un estupor, como si mirara la historia de alguien más, como si fuera algún otro desdichado el que lloriqueaba con los ojos entrecerrados dentro de su suéter de lana en la conferencia de prensa. A todos nos preocupa la seguridad de mi esposa, escuchó decir al pobre. Tiene 9 meses de embarazo y se encuentra muy vulnerable, muy vulnerable. Koledith hubiera odiado eso. Nunca había sido vulnerable en su vida, ya no digamos invisible. No se le podía pasar por alto. Tenía una abundante y rebelde cabellera roja que revoloteaba como un tornado alrededor de su carita perfecta y caminaba con rápidas y atrevidas zancadas. Nunca era ella, sino los demás quienes tenían que apartarse. Pero tal y como ella había predicho, el embarazo la había cambiado. Parecía encogerse dentro de sí mientras se hinchaba más y más, convirtiéndose en la mitad de lo que antes fue, aunque cuando su físico se había duplicado. Su cabello permanecía ahora estático sobre su cabeza, convirtiéndose en un enmarañado desastre color rosa. Caminaba trabajosamente como si todo a su alrededor fuera lodo y arenas movedizas. Estaba demasiado visible y, al mismo tiempo, desapareciendo lentamente. Sí. Pues, I wonder if also, actually in the technical part of the language, with two languages that are so different, do you notice that when you write in English, there's a cadence like that comes from Welsh that maybe changes the way that you write somehow, or the playfulness of the language that you use?
I think there is a certain identity there. When I was, I did a creative writing course in East Anglia, in Norwich, and whatever I would write for the workshops, people would always go on about this Welsh lilt in my writing, and it used to drive me mad because I didn't really know what they were talking about. But I guess we are so conscious of our language when we write. The rhythms, you probably heard it there when I was reading, but the rhythms of our language are very peculiar. There's something very, very poetic about the Welsh language. I think it's because the bardic tradition goes back so far. And we have this strict meter called Cynghanedd, where words and sounds correspond to one another. Some poets are really obsessed with this. I mean, I'm not a poet myself, but I think that a degree of that has influenced the way that I write. So I'm always concerned with the rhythm of the sentence. It has to sound right. And I am aware that sometimes I'm writing something with a certain Welsh rhythm. And when you do it the other way around, when something in Welsh is unduly influenced by, say, the syntax or the structure of an English sentence, it sounds awkward or clumsy, and that's something, you know, you tend to get berated for by Welsh language critics. They're like, oh, you can tell that this is something that, you know, has been influenced by English. So it's a tricky thing to manage when you're going back and forth. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because, as a matter of fact, we were just talking something that Fleer didn't actually know, that the Spanish translation of the Mabinogion was done by Victoria Cirlot, whose father was a poet, very important poet, named Juan Eduardo Cirlot. And Juan Eduardo Cirlot wrote his kind of most important poem is called Bronwyn, and it was... the whole point of the poem is exactly not even meaning, but the sound in the syllables and the placement of the syllables and the sound, which I know must go back to the Welsh idea of poetry.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that other poets and other cultures can still pick up on this, and I know that our bardic tradition is something that people are fascinated with, because it's curious to me that a younger generation of poets, especially young men in their 20s, are obsessed with this form that dates back to the 6th century, and they are writing in this form and performing on stage and almost like using it as a method to seduce women. It's like, you know, like I don't know, poets are like kings in Wales. I think if you're a fiction writer, you're down there somewhere, but poets are still heralded as kings. We have a huge poetry competition every year in our big cultural festival, and winning a chair is the biggest accolade of all, okay? It's just a chair, it's a wooden chair, but if you win one of those, you're like... You know, you're like royalty, and you have this whole ceremony where there's a sword held above your head, and you ask the audience to say your name and let you sit in the chair. And this is something that fiction writers also can enter. And I won one of these competitions, but having you're then known as like the chief prose writer of the year, which is a weird title to have. but our tradition, we'd still take these things really, really seriously. And on the one hand, I'm thinking we're ridiculous to do that. But at the same time, I think it's great that tradition, absolutely, you know, that it carries on, and that every year in this cultural festival, we walk around in robes. And we still carry on this tradition because it's what we have that is uniquely ours. It doesn't matter that we look ridiculous. We're still going to carry on with it.
Sounds great. Continuing tradition is, there's something to say for that. I figured this is interesting because it brings us now to the idea of the libraries, the national libraries we were talking about. Fleer has her newest novel. She's just sold actually you've just gotten
we've just secured funding to make it into a movie, so it's going into production at the end of the year.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the novel and about the film?
Okay, this is it's a novel set in the National Library of Wales, which is this really iconic building. It's on this hill in a small seaside town, really. It's one of the strange institutions that is not set in the capital city, and I think that's great because it's nice when an institution is somewhere else in Wales. And it's basically the building that holds all our treasures and all our artworks and everything that's important, that says something about our culture. And I decided in the story that I wanted to write something unusual, that's a thriller set in a library, which obviously is something you maybe don't see very often. Two librarians, female librarians, go in there with guns to hold an academic hostage and to force him to do all sorts of weird things. And it all happens during a night shift, and a night porter intervenes, and it's kind of like a mad chase around the library. And it was interesting hearing the Argentinian director, Campanella, talk about his film, because it's one of our main references for our movie, because he crosses a lot of genres. We were hoping to do the same thing, and we pitched this to our panel saying we want to make a film like this. So I'm very grateful to him for making that film and for giving us something that we could show as a reference, because that's also what we want to do, and use our cultural identity as well to say something different about the country, but using an institution that, you know, in the backdrop of every scene, you'll have all the artworks and all the medieval manuscripts and everything that says something about our historical narrative.
Did you actually know that there's a Welsh-speaking community in Argentina?
Yes, in Patagonia.
Yeah.
This is something else we're quite obsessed with. There was a film made called Patagonia a few years ago, and the idea of them all sailing away from Wales, thinking we'll start again from scratch, I think that's wonderful. And so when you get people coming over from Patagonia to Wales, and they have this curious Welsh-Spanish accent, it's the most wonderful thing to listen to, because you've got two sets of different rhythms going on there. But it's again something that it's written about a lot in Welsh, actually, Patagonia, and people, the historical narrative of people going out. It's something we're a bit obsessed with, I think, because they actually did it. They left. They were brave enough to leave and start elsewhere, you know. So it's a great story.
Yeah, it is, actually, that they would keep the language, going. And it's funny because I was reading, you know, as I was reading about Welsh and as I was reading about, which gave me the opportunity to read a little bit about the native languages of Colombia, I read that during World War II, particularly, the people who do code often use minority languages because there's so few people that can speak them. So they use, Welsh is actually one of the languages that they use often.
Yeah, yeah.
But that they wouldn't do it in the Falklands War because they were afraid that they would figure it out. Use the Welsh as their code language.
Yeah. Oh, it's really interesting to me to hear things like that. You know, this idea of this kind of unbreakable language, almost like the secret language. But I think about some families who, you know, there's a whole generation, I think, who missed out on the Welsh language because their parents made the decision to only speak English to them. This is coming from Welsh-speaking families who were told English is the language of advancement, and you'll have better chance of getting on in the world if you speak English. So this was something drummed into us by the English and by the government. then those parents then used Welsh as a secret language also when they wanted to say something to each other that the kids, so the kids wouldn't understand. They used it as a secret language. And but if that generation have kind of built up a kind of bitterness about that, I guess, mm-hmm. you know. And now I'm hoping that things are turning around, that a lot of non-Welsh-speaking parents are sending their children to a Welsh-speaking school because they're saying, oh, actually, if you are bilingual, you're going to have more sort of employment prospects, that you might get on better in the world. And that kind of mentality is changing a lot now. And so, you know, half of the student, the parents I see at the school gates are not Welsh-speakers, but their children will be, and that's a fantastically positive thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's also very kind of symbolic that you are setting your movie in the Welsh library, isn't it? As a place, like a gathering place.
Yeah. Well, we talked earlier about the importance of libraries, and the National Library is just this wonderfully iconic institution, but also as not just the fact that it represents culture and learning and history, but the fact that the library is such an open space and it's not judgmental. It's anybody can go into the National Library. You can walk in, you can read. And it's the same is true for all those small public libraries we all have in different areas, that they exclude no one. And that's a fantastic thing. And I was saying to Valerie, I was doing a reading tour around public libraries in Wales. And there's this one guy who just always comes there to drink beer out of a plastic bag. And he was there listening very attentively to me going on and on about the identity of language. And I thought, well, isn't it fantastic that all different sort of walks of life can just congregate here and it's open to everybody? And I guess that's the very symbolic notion of it. That's why I want to make my film in a building like that. It represents our freedom, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me a little bit about your music also, mm-hmm. because that's a big part, actually a very, very famous folk singer in Wales, and if you go to YouTube, you can see her singing in different venues. And did you sing before you wrote? How did it?
Well, to me, like being a singer was like one of these like fantasies of childhood. Like you always, you know, you listen to music and you sing along and you imagine yourself in the band, but you never really think it's going to become a reality. And I think that unless I was a Welsh language speaker, I don't think I'd be doing it, because what I started to see was that there was a sort of a gap there, I guess, for kind of my kind of music, and that it fit into that that scene and that culture. And there's a long tradition of, I guess, pop singers singing sort of protest songs and keeping the language alive. A lot of that radical time in the 60s and 70s, a lot of it was also people, the crowd who were protesting by day, going to Welsh language gigs in the evening, and there were really sort of iconic singers then. And I started a band, and it all fell apart because we were a band of women, and you should never stick women together in a band because the tension just mounts and mounts. We all went crazy. And one night the lead singer didn't turn up. And so I found myself just singing and I'd written the songs, but for some reason I never thought that I could sing them. And it was just that one night I sang the whole set, and then I thought, oh, maybe I could do this. And so I started another band with my husband, and we made the musicians that we knew kind of come along and jam with us. And before we knew it, we had an album. We produced 4 albums now. And I must admit, I'm starting to wind down because I think I really want to concentrate on my writing, my fiction, and because singing and going to gigs and performing and doing, you know, radio gigs and television, it gets very, very exhausting after a while. So I think after that last album, the 4th album, I want to take a bit of a break. But it's what's great for a writer is that singing brings you into contact with an audience and you see their response. It's immediate, you know. You write a book, you have to wait for ages for anybody to say anything about it. And what's great about a song is that you know instantly if it's working or not. And it's just, it's given me a social life, basically, which was much needed.
And do you find writing for radio and for television and now for film, screenwriting, they're completely different forms from the novel. What do you think?
Well, it's I find that writing for screen and writing drama for television is kind of a maddening experience, because as an author, you feel that you know the basics of writing, and then a sort of producer or a production team will come along and tell you that everything you're doing is wrong and that you haven't got it. And there's a whole sort of discussion that always goes on about what is credible in a character's life. And I used to be a writer for a soap opera, Welsh language soap opera, and it used to drive me insane that they would say, yes, but would the character really do this? You know, this is contradictory. And I would want to scream, people are contradictory. They do things like this all the time. But when you have to toe the line in a team, I guess it does teach you a certain discipline. But that soap opera, it would start to drive me mad because my cliffhangers that were given to me by a storylining team were getting less and less credible and interesting. I think one cliffhanger I had was, oh, are they going to start selling organic vegetables in the shop? And then I decided that is not an interesting thing for me to be doing anymore. So I walked away from that job and took 10 years out. I've been working in as a creative writing lecturer. And now I've come back into contact with a director who I really want to work with and a script editor I really want to work with. So going back to write original stuff for television has been a revelation. There are still things I think, you know, I'm struggling with. I'm struggling to get over the fact that I don't get it right with the first draft or second draft or third draft, and it's ongoing. But I think, again, the discipline is something that is going to give me such experience when I go back then to writing novels. I think it's going to be a really important learning curve.
Fantastic. Well, would you like to hear her sing a song?
Oh, they only asked me to do this yesterday. Okay, I have to do it a cappella, so forgive me if it all goes wrong.
And afterwards, we'll open for questions from the audience. Do you want their...
Are they giving me a
microphone? Yeah.
Hello. Okay, I usually perform with instruments. Now I feel like I'm about 10 years old and I'm about to sing in a singing competition and you're all going to judge me. So, okay, here goes. This is a Welsh folk tune. It's very, very depressing about a woman's lover going off onto the sea and she never sees him again. But that's the nature of Welsh language folk tunes. Os daw'n nghariad yma heno, yma heno, i guro'r gwydr glas. Rhowch ateb gweddus iddo, gweddus iddo, na tebwch monon gas. Nad ydw'r ferch ddim gatre, na'i wallus dan y tŷ. Llanc ifanc o blwy arall, o blwy arall, sydd wedi mynd â hi. Be meddwn Edyn erir, edyn erir, mi fyddwn llawer gwell. I hedeg at fy nghariad, sydd yn y gwledydd pell. Dros diroedd maeth a moroedd, rwy'n gobeithio ei fod yn iach. Rwy'n caru'r tir lle cerddodd, tir lle cerddodd, o wraidd fy ngalonfa.
Goosebumps. It's very beautiful.
You have to give me your marks later on, okay?
We'll open to some questions now. Would anybody like to ask Lear?
Hello. Hello. What you said about folkloric representations of women, I found very interesting in Welsh folk tales. Do you think all folk tales from all cultures have that sort of representation of women? Because a lot of the indigenous cultures here seem to have tales which they're very egalitarian and they don't criticize women. Do you think there's something particularly in Welsh culture about that which makes it a macho narrative, a macho criticism of women?
It is possible that that's something that is present in Welsh culture that isn't present in others. And sometimes I see it as well in the kind of the literary tradition, and there might be a kind of a misogyny there. When I was talking about the bardic tradition and these young men taking over the old Welsh Strychnita, it's traditionally like that still the male writers who are taking over the Strychnita, and there are some people just saying, oh, you know, there aren't many women writing the Strychnita, you know, because it's too hard for them. Or there was one poet who argued that it was biologically impossible for women in Wales to write the Strychnita. You know, he is insane. And he's one of the people I satirise in my novel about the National Library. So the whole plot of the National Library, I guess, taps into this, because in the novel, the female librarian, the chief exec, is trying to get rid of all the literature written by males in Wales. And I think maybe that's a kind of a playful response to that. And it's interesting to hear that in other cultures, women are not seen in that way. And because if you think, yeah, in some oral tales, I guess you have the figure of the mother being all important. And the mother is the head of the family. And, you know, the mothers are the ones that give birth and look after the children, and they are figureheads. But in the Mabinogion, you don't get that at all. You don't get the sense of the woman is very important. She's the one who continues the family line. You usually get this very sort of dark undercurrent. Maybe that is somewhere along the line something to do with how the, you know, that Welsh cultural tradition has developed. Because, yeah, in the 6th century, all the men were writing that poetry, and still now, you know, it's mainly the men who are still doing it. So, yeah, that's a really interesting point, though. And it would be great to sort of look at other folk tales and see what other things I can get out of them. Yeah. Thank you.
In many respects, English is a mongrel language that picks up words here and there, everywhere, and over the centuries has become incredibly rich in terms of the vocabulary, mm-hmm. With lots of words that are almost identical, but not exactly identical. And I couldn't help but notice that when you were reading your passage in Welsh, it took about half as long as it took to read in English. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious as to whether you have any difficulties at time with expressing a sentiment or just a sentence in Welsh, because it isn't as rich as English is.
It's a good question, because I think that sometimes when I'm translating, I do a fair bit of translating from Welsh into English and English into Welsh. When I'm translating from Welsh into English, I find it quite easy, and it comes really, really quickly, because I know the vocabulary I want to use. When I'm doing it the other way around, I find it a struggle, because I find it a struggle to make it sound as natural in Welsh when it's coming from the English. There is a large vocabulary in Welsh, but the problem is that a lot of those words seem sometimes archaic to the contemporary users now. Like, there are words that are kind of going out of fashion, and I sometimes make a point of not, well, making my own words up, which annoys my critics sometimes, and also trying to use some of the older Welsh words. And I use this old Welsh dictionary, so I try to make use of the older words for things, and but with contemporary readers, yeah, you're right. It's I guess sometimes they find it easier, because there is a huge vocabulary there in English, as you say, and there are certain lines in my sort of English language novel. Someone was pointing out to me, you would never be able to say that in Welsh. The vocabulary just isn't there. But there's a different kind of vocabulary. It's a kind of more rhythmic, emotionally rich, complex one. But you can't. Yeah, you can't express exactly the same thing. And it is, yeah, I guess that's the difference between a majority and a minority language, isn't it? Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about these novels or writers who explore writing in a new language that happens, for example, in contact zones, territories or countries where two different cultures meet and clash. So I was thinking, for example, in Latin America about there's this novel of a Peruvian writer, José María Arguedas, who wrote Los Ríos Profundos, which is a beautiful novel written in both Spanish and Quechua. And I was thinking as well, for example, in Junot Díaz, who writes in Spanglish, and many other writers who explore two different languages in one place, or explore this new language that has been born in these contact zone territories. So I was wondering, is there something like this? Is there a sort of Spanish equivalent for Welsh and English? And if there is, would you ever consider using it in your literature writing?
Well, you mean combining, so combining languages, Well, often when we speak Welsh that is imperfect or impure, people, and it's sort of polluted by English words, people call it Wenglish. So, we're often told off in school, you know, it's like, you're speaking Wenglish, speak a proper language, you know, make a decision, speak one or the other, don't combine them. So, a lot of, I guess, if you're a Welsh language speaker, you try to keep it pure. For an English language speaker in Wales, for example, there's a poet I know, Lloyd Robson, who likes to combine Welsh and English and different dialects from the city with his English language writing. And he has a problem with being called an English writer because he says, no, I'm Welsh, you know, I'm from Wales, I might be from the city. A lot of people in the city do speak English, but he was on this kind of mission to rename the English language because he just felt it wasn't the language he was using in his poetry. This was something that was Welsh, but you couldn't call it Welsh because there's another language that is Welsh. So that's something that I think a lot of writers in Wales struggle with, especially if they're English language writers in Wales. And they used to be called Anglo-Welsh writers, and then everybody kind of started to protest against that because they didn't like the Anglo bit. They didn't want to be Anglo-Welsh. They were Welsh, but they just wrote in English. So now we call it Welsh writing in English, which is doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but that's what the politically correct term for it is now. But it's a really interesting field, and a lot of the academics that I work in my university, they really love getting to grips with the Welsh writing in English because it's so fascinating, because it's a crossover of everything, really.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
¿Puedo preguntar en español? Buenas tardes. Buenas. ¿Puedo preguntar en español? Ah, ok.
Translation.
You're having translation? Sí. Ahora sí. Adelante.
Sí, en primer lugar quiero agradecer esta disertación tan interesante sobre lingüística y sociolingüística más que sobre literatura y poesía.
No. Sí, sí, ¿hay traducción? Sí.
Oh, okay, it's volume, I think.
¿Qué canal?
Okay, yeah.
Sí. Okay.
Yep.
Adelante.
Gracias. Perdona. En primer lugar, quiero agradecer esta disertación sobre sociolingüística y etnolingüística que hemos oído aquí. Pero me asalta una pregunta, más que una pregunta, comentarios y de pronto saber esto un poco más sobre la métrica del galés. Tenemos muchas cosas en común en las lenguas latinoamericanas y sobre todo en las lenguas colombianas. Y pienso que esto es bastante interesante, soy lingüista y me llama mucho la atención esto de la métrica. Yo quisiera saber si esto de la métrica del galés que tanto se ha hablado ocurre en la lengua natural, en la lengua social, en la lengua común y corriente, o solo la usan los poetas y los escritores para la narrativa y para la prosa y para la poesía. porque es natural en lenguas como el wayunaiki, en la guajira colombiana, por ejemplo, que los palabreros usen unos códigos que podrían ser métrica, y algunas otras lenguas indígenas colombianas que usan otro código fuera de la lengua común para expresar textos religiosos o textos míticos o otro tipo de textos. Me llama la atención y quisiera saber en primer lugar si esa métrica de la cual se ha hablado para el galés es una métrica de la lengua común y corriente, o si por el contrario es una métrica que usan solo los poetas y los prosistas y los narradores. De otra parte, también quisiera agradecer un comentario acerca de por qué se ve impuro el hecho de que alguien galés use códigos o léxico del inglés. Las lenguas son dinámicas, las lenguas son, y eso no lo para nadie, las influencias mutuas en un mundo contemporáneo son inevitables. Y yo no puedo evitar decir en español kindergarten, por ejemplo, y las lenguas adoptan esas palabras. Y eso no es ningún problema para el lingüista. De pronto, para una academia purista que no quiere calco de otras lenguas, lo impida y lo prohíba, pero en el pueblo común y corriente eso no lo para nadie. Eso no, ni hace a la lengua más compleja, ni hace a la lengua menos compleja. Quisiera un comentario al respecto. Muchas gracias.
Gracias.
Thank you for those really interesting questions there. What you ask about the people, you know, being critical about the language becoming impure and because it's like a cross pollination of different influences, I think you're completely right, and I think language evolves and language takes on different influences, and there are a whole kind of generation of school kids now, you know, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, and they have, you know, contemporary culture, Anglo-American culture. It's all informing their language. And they may speak well sometimes with the syntax of English, so they will speak English Welsh in a certain way, which is not correct. But for me, I just feel if they're speaking Welsh, I'm happy. That's all I care about. And I'm hoping that we're coming out of that period where these kind of critics of language are telling us how we can and cannot speak, because there's a thing in our language, we mutate letters, so say B turns to an F depending on the word that comes before it, and mutation is like this huge thing. So if you're on radio and you make a mistake, you mutate the wrong letter, and you kick yourself because you think, oh, the language purists are listening to me, they think I can't speak my language. This is just a kind of a mentality, and it's comical and farcical to me as well, which is why in a lot of the Welsh language work that I do satirize these critics of language, because, you know, I feel like they're just sitting in a room, just making a note of everybody's mistakes, and that is something that really stops a language from moving on. If young children start to feel that every time they speak a language, and if they make a mistake, that someone's going to criticise them, they're not going to want to speak it. So for me, as long as they're speaking Welsh, doesn't matter if it's incorrect, doesn't matter if it's impure, it's still evolving, it's still continuing, they're still finding it an appealing language to use. As to your other question, I'm trying to remember this correctly now, the strict meter called Cynghanedd is something that is used exclusively in poetry, but there are a whole kind of generation of poets who are tweeting now in Cynghanedd, and it's becoming more part of kind of social media, and there are Welsh rap as well. Welsh language rap is evolving and including all sorts of forms of strict meter combined with like rap that's being influenced from America. So I think all these interesting forms are developing now in our contemporary world, and Welsh is becoming a new language, and hopefully it's becoming a contemporary language, because we can't just exist within the arts. We have to have, you know, business minds and people in the sciences and people who are still going to push our language forward and make it evolve and make it interesting and make it a language of the world. So yeah, it's even though that Cynghanedd meter is staying within poetry, there are a lot of people who use it in speech, but it's not something that's particular to the way that we speak. I wouldn't be able to speak in Cynghanedd, but some authors, some show-offs would be able to do it. But thank you for a really interesting question there.
We have one time for one last question here, and and then we'll.
Clear. I just wondered, given the ignorance and indifference that most English people show towards Welsh culture and Welsh language, whether there is, in your view, a case, as a lot of Scots have concluded, for Wales to become an independent country?
Well, I'd love to see Wales becoming an independent country, and I think that the way the country functions, that we have to make tiny baby steps towards that, because there's still a lot of, there's a lack of confidence there still, that if you, and if you do it too quickly, then you don't want people voting against it, because in 79, when we had our devolution vote, you know, the majority of the country voted against having their own government, which seems totally insane. I mean, why would a country vote against that? Why would they not want to govern their own affairs? But at that time, people felt so, you know, they wanted to be British, they were afraid of breaking away. And then in 97, we had the yes vote, but it was only a small margin, it was 1%. So you still feel that you've still got to win people over and to make them sort of not afraid of being independent. It'd be really interesting to see what happens in Scotland. And, you know, we do look at, you know, we look up at the Scottish situation and we kind of would like to be in their shoes. But perhaps there's less of a kind of linguistic issue there as well, which makes it easier for them in some ways to take bold strides towards independence. So I would like to see it happening, but I wouldn't want us to rush into it for fear of, you know, having a no vote, which would just be devastating. So I think we're kind of slowly moving on in the right direction. And I think a lot of people who campaign for that have just had to accept that we have to move at a snail's pace to get what we want. It's difficult for an impatient person like me, but I keep the faith that it will happen one day.
Well, thank you so much, Fleur, for being with us.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Thank you for singing to us and for bringing the world, making the world a little bit smaller. Thank you all for being here.
And thank you, Valerie, as well.